Ladies and gentlemen, podcasting since 2005, you're listening to Gamertag Radio with your host, podcaster Hall of Famer Danny Pena, the always opinionated Paris Lilly, and from outside of the norm, Peter Toledo. This is Gamertag Radio.
Hey, Gamertag Radio listeners, welcome, welcome, and this is your host, Danny, and wow, we have a special, special treat for you guys for Daily Conversation. We haven't done a Daily Conversation in a while, ever since, I think, oh my God, before E3. I used to do that a lot with Paris, but we have a special Daily Conversation with the one and only Peter Moore. Yes, Peter and I have been talking now for a couple months. Right now he, left the gaming industry and he's the CEO of Liverpool Football Club. Now they're in the UK. And we were talking in September is the 20th anniversary of the Sega Dreamcast. And I've been thinking about this for a while now. I was like, you know what? I think it would be cool to call Peter Moore and see if we could have a conversation about just memories of the Sega Dreamcast, man. You know, we had a long conversation. I believe it was like a good 36, 35 minutes long conversation. But just memories, man. Like how was getting into working into Sega? Because if for those who don't know, Peter Moore used to work at Reebok. And he had no idea about anything about video games. And he started working at Sega for Sega Dreamcast. And then after that, Xbox and EA, EA Sports, all that. So we talked about everything. I'm talking about the business, games, the marketing, the good, the bad, the ugly, all that stuff, man. It was really cool. Great conversation. I just want to say thank you to Peter Moore for him taking his time to record this podcast and also his team over there at Liverpool. Thank you so much, man, for just helping me out because I've been talking to them now since, April, May around there. And we finally made it happen. So a month before the 20th anniversary of Sega Dreamcast. So listen to the episode and let me know what you think. We'll be right back after this.
Send us your feedback or questions. Give us a call at 786-273-7GTR. Email us at fanmail@gamertagradio.com. Or leave a message on speakpipe.com/gamertagradio.
Cool, man. How's everything, man?
Everything's fine. I'm currently in Geneva, Switzerland. We've got a game here tomorrow and then heading back to the UK. And we play Wembley on Sunday against Manchester City. So it's nonstop.
Well, first of all, I want to say congrats. I know you guys won, right? A month ago, 2 months ago?
June 1st. Yeah, we won the Champions League.
Yeah, that's cool, man. Very cool.
Yeah. It was a long season.
Nice. Now, so this is more like a conversation. I don't know, interview and then like a more conversation. I'm recording and everything. Yeah. So, the 20th anniversary, man, Sega Dreamcast is coming up, man. That's crazy, right?
I know. Yeah. It's hard to believe 20 years ago. And it's funny. I was in LA a couple of weeks ago and did something for Sega of Japan. It's the 60th anniversary of Sega.
Wow.
I sat down with them and talked about my memories of my days. And I think they're combining the two. They're more obviously Japanese focused than the Dreamcast actually for them. If you recall, was 1998. So they've already had their 20th anniversary. But yeah, it's amazing how time flies on this stuff.
Yeah, man. Well, before we start talking about Sega Dreamcast, man, I know because I follow you on Facebook and I remember when your team won, you said that at first it was like a risk going from the gaming industry to this, to like soccer. So how was the process of going from the gaming side to that? Like for you, was it very scary at first or what?
Well, I don't know if it's scary, but you have to reinvent yourself one more time. And, you get on in your career and you've achieved a lot. You've, in my life, I've done probably, I don't know, three separate careers. I'm actually a PE teacher by profession and education, mm-hmm. but that didn't last too long. I wanted more than that. And then I got into sports marketing for 20 years, primarily back there in the States with a company called Patrick and then Reebok. And then made a career change, complete career change, and joined Sega in 1998, late 98, early 99. And, you know, dove into the world of video games. And I had to learn that and learn the industry and learn the profession. And so, and that was, so that's 20 years of that, actually 19 years. And then 2 years ago, I had the opportunity to move back to Liverpool where I was born and learn the football business in the industry. And, so you've got to reinvent yourself and the opportunity to do something spectacular at the end of your career. This is the end of my career. Mm-hmm. You know, everybody should have that opportunity and everybody should, be as lucky as me that I've got the opportunity actually to give back so much what I learned in video games, digital transformation, different business models, managing, your customer base, how you build and grow. And so many of the lessons learned at both Xbox and obviously more recently EA, we're applying at the football club, which is still a very traditional business. And we're moving rapidly into the digital world with database management, fan acquisition, fan engagement, all of the stuff that is kind of second nature in video games.
Mm. Now going into the whole Sega and video games, like how stressful it was, man, because Sega at that time, they had a lot of challenges, especially because of what happened with Sega Saturn. How difficult and how challenging that was for you, you know, starting to work at Sega at that time before the launch of the Sega Dreamcast?
Well, I could probably look back and now say I wasn't quite aware of what I was getting myself into as regards what needed to be done to, first of all, get respect back for the Sega brand after the difficult times of the Saturn, I guess, and really until I got into Sega America and got into the industry and got a deep knowledge from talking to hundreds of gamers, how burned they feel about the Saturn. It was a botched launch. It was a console that I'm not sure it lasted 3 years. And, you know, you've got to win back respect. And that was a shame because it came on obviously the heels of a phenomenal console in the Genesis that, you know, broke down so many barriers and it was a fun time, you know, Sega versus Nintendo and the Sega brand as a rebel, irreverent brand was then formed. And it was my job really to capture those times again, almost pretend the Saturn hadn't happened and win back through the irreverency that we used for the Dreamcast to win back those Sega fans. And I think we did. But not enough of them, I guess, was the lesson learned in the end.
Yeah. You know, I think in our lifetime, we're never going to see a launch like Sega Dreamcast, I think, man, because the launch day was like one of the greatest launch dates ever. And just the launch titles also that came out that time was amazing. And how was it for you? Like, I know every time 9/9 pops up during the anniversary of Sega Dreamcast, you always post something, a picture of the console or something. Like, how important was that day for you?
Well, it was critically important, not just for me, but for the people that had worked so hard, both in San Francisco as well as in Japan, to get the platform ready, to get online gaming poised ready to go, to get the marketing right, to get our production numbers right. And you look back to your point, you look back at that launch lineup, and it's only in retrospect 20 years later and, you know, four different launches since then of cycle transitions that you realize it's probably the greatest launch lineup in history, particularly when you see how much brand new intellectual property was there on day one. And you just don't get that anymore for a number of reasons. But, you know, obviously you had Soul Calibur, which wasn't new IP and Sonic wasn't. But, you know, Trickstyle, Hydro Thunder, Ready to Rumble, all of that, Power Stone, all of these things at launch really created probably too many titles at launch. I mean, one of the things you can look back at and say, maybe it should have been spread out a little bit. But, you know, you think about, I think it was 18, 19 titles at launch, and then, you know, followed very quickly by the sports titles. It just was overwhelming how good it was. And I think the consumer, the gamer, was overwhelmed because they were spoiled for choice. Yeah, do I play Ready to Rumble? Do I play Power Stone? Do I play Sonic Adventure? Soul Calibur, I think, was probably the best quality title at launch. So from that perspective, you know, you look back. Yeah, and it's only when you can look back 2 decades now and you've seen all the launches subsequent. Yeah, it was a huge day for me personally. It's a huge day for Sega America right there at 650 Townsend and all the people that have worked hard. And boy, I mean, we kicked it off with, you know, a bang with the VMAs and everything we did, both goofy and straight up to get ahead of the impending PS2 launch.
Yeah, I remember one of my first ever gaming event that I ever attended was for the launch of SegaNet, and it was NFL 2K1 came out at that time too.
Yeah.
You guys at the time sponsored the VMAs for the second time. It was in 2000.
That's right. Yeah.
Yeah, and it was in New York City, and I went to the event. I was like mind blown playing NFL 2K1 on a 56K modem. I was like, wow, no lag. Amazing.
Yeah. Yeah.
Amazing.
Yeah. How, you know, that was Visual Concepts in Marin County, Greg Thomas, who now do NBA 2K obviously. And, they found ways of masking latency, and you know, I learned more about TCP/IP, you know, over IP, and than I would ever dreamt. And yeah, 56K board modem. I mean, goodness gracious, it was incredible what they're able to do.
Yeah, I mean, was that a good idea to have that deal where you subscribe to SegaNet and you get a Sega Dreamcast for free? It looked to me as like, okay, now it's getting desperate. Like, oh, this is not looking good for Sega. Well, you think that was that a good idea at that time to do that, just to continue the business?
Well, I think it was probably an ill-thought-out idea on several levels. There was a lot of fraud involved in that, where people would accept the Dreamcast and then disappear. I during that period of time, you've got to remember that software was driving hardware very aggressively, and people wanted to use hardware as a way to lure you into signing up into subscription businesses. And I think what we were probably looking at was the success, if it was success, that AOL had a few years prior. If you recall, and maybe you're too young, but AOL was giving you, like, if you bought a laptop with AOL loaded on the desktop, and signed up, you got $400 back.
Yeah, I remember that.
And it's like, yeah. Wow. And so why wouldn't you? And I think what we looked at is how could we lure people into subscribing, because it was a pretty new business model in those days. This is way before Xbox Live, obviously, and PlayStation Network. It was a brand new business model, and we had to get people. You know, you almost had to make them an offer you couldn't refuse. But it was fraught with fraud, where people would accept the Dreamcast and then disappear. And the churn was pretty heavy as well. And we learned a lot about churn and retention and managing churn, which to this day is never easy.
Yeah, I remember I was at Microsoft. I think it was for some Lord of the Rings game for the Xbox 360 at the time. And we were sitting down. And you started doing like an introduction there about yourself. And then you mentioned a story about, I think you were at an airport. I don't know if it was the TSA or I think it was the TSA.
Yes,
that they said to you,
Shenmue.
Yeah, Shenmue. They were like, I don't need to see your passport. You're the asshole that gave away the
exactly right.
Shenmue to Xbox. Yeah.
That guy was bitter.
Yeah, I mean, it's still to this day, there's going to be a lot of people, Peter, that are always going to blame you for that. Like, man, Shenmue 2 never came out for the Sega Dreamcast here in the States.
Yeah, I mean, it was, sure, whatever. you know, I get blamed for a lot of things. I work for a football club now. You think gaming stuff, you could work for a football club with 700 million fans like Liverpool has, and we're champions of Europe, but, you know, I'm getting blamed all day long for all kinds of stuff. No, that was never the case. It was never, ever, ever going to be on the Dreamcast. You know, Microsoft had funded some of the development with Suzuki-san, and, you know, the Dreamcast, unfortunately, was in the death throes at that time. It was never, ever, ever going to be on the Dreamcast. But that's a decision made at the development level in Haneda in Tokyo, nothing to do with me. Mm-hmm. But what I did do was bridge the gap, you know, from when we had to unfortunately pack it in as regards selling hardware, and bridge the gap with Microsoft and Xbox, because we needed a savior. We needed the cavalry to ride in to help out. And they were very good in helping us with dev kits immediately, as well as providing incentives to the developers to develop for Xbox. And it was the original Xbox 360, obviously, mm-hmm. had not launched. So, yeah, I get blamed for a lot, Danny.
You're listening to Gamertag Radio.
Hey, let's talk about a brand new sponsor for this episode of Gamertag Radio, Mint Mobile. If you're still using one of the big wireless providers in 2019, have you asked yourself, what are you paying for? Between expensive retail stores, inflated prices, and hidden fees, you are being taken advantage of because they know you will pay. Enter Mint Mobile. Mint Mobile provides the same premium network coverage you're used to, but at a fraction of the cost because everything is online. Mint Mobile saves on retail locations and overhead, then passes those savings directly to you. And I'm telling you, this is super cheap. If you're planning to buy any of these games that's coming out later this year, instead of, you know, paying a lot for a phone, why not go with Mint Mobile and save some money? And with that, you could actually buy some video games, man. And there's a lot coming up in September, a lot coming up for this holiday season. Take advantage of that. Mint Mobile makes it easy to cut your wireless bill down to just $15 a month. 15. Every plan comes with unlimited nation talk and text. With Mint Mobile, stop paying for unlimited data you will never use. Choose between plans with 3, 8, or even 12 gigabytes of 4G LTE data. Use your phone with any Mint Mobile plan and keep your same phone number along with your existing contacts. Ditch your old wireless bill and start saving with Mint Mobile. To get your new wireless plan for just $15 a month, get the plan shipped to your door for free. Go to mintmobile.com/GTR. That's mintmobile.com/GTR. Cut your wireless bill to $15 a month. Right now, go to mintmobile.com/GTR.
This is Gamertag Radio. Voicemail at 786-2737-GTR.
Was there a game that came out after launch that to you, it's like one of those, like, man, it's like a hidden gem for Sega Dreamcast that still to this day, I, you know, here and there, I'll think about it once the anniversary of Dreamcast pops up.
I think, you know, I will never forget Seaman. You know, if you want something that embodies and typifies the quirky nature, first of all, of Japanese gaming, but also what Sega was willing to support and publish, you know, it was Thief. And as weird a game as you've ever seen, of basically, you know, you're a manfish, if you remember the game.
Mm-hmm, I remember. Yep.
You know, floating around the TV, you had to feed it, you had to encourage you, had to talk to it. It talked back to you. It kind of got to know what you were up to, and it was just spooky. But it was, you know, a classic, almost like a demo for artificial intelligence through a video game that showed how it could learn, how it could do voice recognition. And, you know, I thought it was very clever, very unique. But it was, you know, towards the end of the Dreamcast, and it was never going to be a game that would sell millions of copies, never going to be a game that would, you know, in any way turn anybody's head, and you wouldn't, I don't think, buy a Dreamcast to play Seaman. But Seaman's the game that always sticks out for me of all the things that I played and all of the things that I was involved in there as a game that was unique and disruptive, I guess, and certainly caused a big stir.
Yeah, for me, the game I always mention, I think I mentioned it to you too in person, the Phantasy Star Online has always been like a special game for me, yeah. Man. You know, that game, actually, I was at the Microsoft press conference this year. And finally, the part two is now coming to the States. It's been out in Japan for so many years. And I was like, man, this is full circle, man. Like, I'm super excited to actually now play part two. But how was that game? Because for you at that time, because I feel like that was like the birth of like all these looter shooters now that they have. They have, you know, Arlong RPG, similar to like Phantasy Star Online from back then. You know, it was like a game changer to me back then, man.
Phantasy Star Online was way ahead of its time as regards exactly what you just said. And, you know, you think about the collaboration, the cooperation, the social element of it, you know, because we're talking 20 years ago. And it was Naka-san, his studio that did it. It also did Sonic. But you look back at it now, and it sat there. I think the only thing that we didn't do well is put a lot more resources behind it to make it a little bit more mass market. It was still a pretty deep, hardcore gamer game. Mm-hmm. When I think that actually it could have benefited from a bit more marketing money and a positioning that was more user-friendly, if you will. The game just felt, too, I won't say nerdy, but there was a core group of players who were going to play it. And it was difficult for you to enter that universe. So we didn't put a ton of resources behind it. It did not feel like a mass market game. And it probably wasn't. But I think it would have benefited from more marketing money.
Yeah, like I feel still to this day, I feel that the Dreamcast, it felt like the company was so hungry because they knew they had to compete with PlayStation, the next PlayStation system that was coming out at that time. But they had like so much content, man. And if you think about it, like I said, Phantasy Star Online, it was a game changer. Even the sports game, NFL 2K, 2K and NBA 2K was amazing at that time too. Online was like ahead of its time for Sega. Like there was so many things that was going on so good for Sega Dreamcast. Why do you think was the failure that everything just went downhill for the company overall? Was it marketing? Was it money? Was it what do you think it was for you?
I think I always credit Sony in doing a tremendous job in flooding the consumer. And by flood, I mean placing fear, uncertainty, and doubt in the minds of the consumer. They convinced the consumer that the Dreamcast was a transitional platform. You know, sure, buy it if you want to. Play it a little bit if you want to. Mm-hmm. But the real console is coming the following March, the PS2. And, you know, that's when the next generation of gaming really starts. That was their message. If you remember, it was the emotion engine. It was like Toy Story comes to life in a game. All of that messaging, to their credit, placed doubt in the minds of the consumer. And so the consumer, in the end, didn't buy. And what happened, you know, at our end, at Sega end, is we just didn't have the install base coming out of that second Christmas that we needed to continue to drive the business. But the challenge, if you don't have enough hardware in homes, you're not going to sell the software. Software is where the money is. The hardware was probably being sold at a loss still then. And you needed your hardware units to go up, your attach rate, the number of games sold in relation to the hardware to go up. Mm-hmm. And unfortunately, those two things didn't get to where they needed to be. And then the following January, of course, we I had to make the very difficult conference call, lead that conference call to explain that we were getting out of the hardware business and we were going to become a third-party software publisher.
How difficult was that to you, man, to talk to?
Oh, terrible.
Talk to like everybody who was involved with Sega at that time. Like, hey, look, you know, we worked really hard on this. We got to make changes. There's going to be layoffs. We're stopping the hardware business. We're strictly going to be sticking with just software. And what made you decide, like, you know what? I think I should just leave Sega and go from Microsoft. Like, how was that process, man, for you?
Well, for me, you know, we made the announcement in January 2001, January 31st, and you know, we then had to do a ton of layoffs. You know, basically anything that was supporting the hardware, anybody that was directly focused on hardware, there was no role for them anymore. So that was sad, and a lot of people, you know, I sat down in my office. I remember that day, and you know, unfortunately said, there's no job for you, and, you know, here's your settlement package, and I wish you all the best. And it was a very difficult day that I still remember to this day. The fact of the matter was, then we fought afterwards for how do we reposition ourselves, we being Sega, in the West. And the problem that I had is I could see games arriving that had, you know, from Western developers that had more of a Western focused, that were appealing to Western gamers. And we weren't delivering that type of game. And the problem was that still at that time, the development heads were king, and they would develop what they wanted rather than take any kind of feedback from certainly outside of Japan or from the subsidiaries like myself. And they just made what they felt was right, which in a lot of cases wasn't right and wasn't going to sell. And it was too Japanese, if you will. Mm-hmm. And so I fought for another year to try to convince them that, you know, and we also saw GTA 3 started to, you know, take root. It was the first GTA that had moved into almost a different genre. And boy, you could just see everything start to change. And of course, at that time, it was a Sony exclusive. Mm-hmm. So, yeah, I lasted another year and a half, I guess. And then I was going back to Japan trying to help redirect the ship. And it just got into more arguments with people and got frustrated. And I remember coming back in December of 2002 and getting off the plane at SFO, and Robbie Bach had called me, you know, to wish me Merry Christmas, I always remember. And said, oh, by the way, you know, I, you know, told him that I was frustrated with where things were. I just didn't have a voice. We weren't being taken seriously. I could see what was happening in the industry. But, you know, if it wasn't happening in Haneda, then it wasn't happening. And as a result, I got frustrated, you know, had some really bad meetings. Robbie said, like you to chat with Steve Ballmer. And I did. And he had seen me as somebody that had fought PlayStation. They felt they needed a figurehead, somebody that could go nose to nose and take on the PlayStation. And so it wasn't that long. It was like a month later, I had agreed to the job. And I had kind of moved up to Seattle, albeit still commuting back into from San Francisco, because my son Tyler was still high school senior, and we didn't want to take him out of high school that time in Marin County.
Was there were there like any stuff that you learned from working at Sega that you were like, you know what, it worked for Sega, I think I should add this into for Xbox and Xbox 360. Was there anything from that you learned?
Well, I think the focus on online. I became a huge believer in online early on. I could see the opportunity. I could see the building of communities. I could see that we were going to drag boys out of their bedrooms. I could see the different game types and the different game mechanics and the brand new genres opening up. And, you know, and it was about that time I coined the phrase with Sega, we're taking gamers where gaming is going. And mm-hmm. and we did. And I still like to think that the Dreamcast passed the baton for online gaming to the Xbox, and in particular the Xbox 360. But what we had learned, what we had achieved, what we started to build was then, you know, enhanced and taken to the next step by both Xbox and PlayStation. The other thing was being a challenger brand, which I enjoyed. And Xbox then was still a challenger brand to the PlayStation. So you're the feisty upstart. You've got a little bit more leeway to do more different things, like to your arms. And, you know, you have a lot more latitude to be a lot more irreverent and poke fun and get after the guy ahead of you. And that's what we did. And yeah. That came out of the Sega experience.
Yeah. Like, I know I mentioned to you that 9.99 was a very special day to me. And another day that was very special was Zero Hour, the launch of Xbox 360. Yeah. Yeah, I have my co-host was there, and we even have an audio roundtable with you and Jay Adler, that you guys had like a Q&A roundtable with content creators at that time too, man. Like that moment reminded me so much of just like the excitement when the Sega Dreamcast came out back in 99. It was like the same yeah. type of vibe, same type of feeling too, man, with Zero Hour, man. And still to this day, it was one of my favorite events that I've ever seen, ever, like in gaming.
Well, so. Zero Hour came together really late. We you know, I felt we needed something big and cool and disruptive. And, you know, a number of my guys went away and we came up with this concept of, you know, let's go do like an Area 51. Let's not make it in L.A., which we made our primary objective is you needed to get there. You needed to be dedicated. And then we're going to let you at it for 24 hours. And so that's how Zero Hour came into effect. And the marketing team, to their credit, pulled it off, found mm-hmm. that huge hangar up there in Palmdale, you know, and it had this Area 51 vibe. You're in the middle of nowhere, and which you were. And it felt so special and so unique. And we felt so honored to be there. And we rolled the trucks in, you remember, at midnight. Mm-hmm. The Best Buy trucks had the Dreamcast, and all of the Dreamcasts were then, you know, the interactives. And if you remember the beanbags, and everybody could play whatever game they wanted, unlimited. It was a blast, and I think what it did, it summoned in and made a statement that this was really different. And I think the Xbox 360, you know, took that day, that night, those 24 hours as a platform. And never stopped. And, mm-hmm. I like to think, and I don't know how the numbers would ever end up, but I'd like to think that Xbox 360 won that cycle, won that period. Won, you know, that it really paved the way for where we are now, which we don't think twice about, which is online gaming.
Yeah.
And Xbox Live. And you know, obviously the other guys have PSN. But the Xbox 360 really blew through any opposition to Xbox Live. And Xbox Live just massively grew, if you call, during that time to, gosh, as many as 60 million people.
Yeah. You know, there was one game that I was always curious about. Jet Set Radio. Jet Set Radio Future. That came out for
Future.
Yeah, that came out for the Xbox. Was that game being developed for the Sega Dreamcast at that time, and then it got canceled? Like, you know what? Let's bring it to Xbox or not?
Boy, I don't remember, Danny. I mean, I'm trying to remember if it ever the games on the Sega Dreamcast were developed on the Naomi motherboard, which was a shared, basically shared GPUs, CPUs with arcade machines. And okay. This is where it made it a lot easier for Sega to do games like Crazy Taxi, because you could push them out on the arcade, and it wasn't that difficult to port them very quickly from the arcade to the home console, mm-hmm. because of the development architecture was identical, and it was the Naomi board. Mm-hmm. Now, Jet Set Radio, I don't recall. It might have been one of those games that once the hardware started to falter, that it was shifted to other platforms. But yeah, it was, as you remember, it was a quirky style that the cartoon type character elements were so unique and difficult, mm-hmm. different. And the music was so funky. You know, it was great music, great soundtracks. I think I still have. You know, that next to my Space Channel 5 soundtrack somewhere.
Yeah.
And so I think, you know, once again, as we started this conversation, you know, Sega, unique, different, quirky, disruptive, challenging the status quo what games were, and gave a real and a real animated view, a tremendous rendering style that was eye catching.
Yeah, I have one more question here. I know there's so many companies now that are bringing back like those old consoles. You know, Nintendo done that already with NES and the Super NES Classic, right? Sega just did that recently now with the Sega Genesis. Would you like to see something like that with Sega Dreamcast in the future? And if you do, what will be like the games that you think it should be? Let's go with just like your three favorite games that you think it should be in that little device.
Well, almost, it sounds easy. Which games would you put on there? The challenge always when you're, in this case, 20 years on or 18 years on, what license rights do you hold? What IP rights do you hold? Was there a music soundtrack? Do you still have the rights to the music? Do you need to strip out characters who you don't have, voice talent rights? I mean, it is not easy to just simply pluck an older game unless you have somehow grandfathered in, in perpetuity, these games. But so the easiest games would be first party games, and it would probably be Sonic that you would have. Midway and Ready to Rumble, Midway don't exist anymore, so I don't know where you go there. And again, you could probably go pay for the rights from whoever owns them, and you would hope all the licenses are still paid up and current. But I think you'd find it'd have to be Sega first party games. And for me, you could go find things like Panzer Dragoon Auto, Orta.
That's an amazing, an amazing game. Yeah,
if you remember that.
Well, that one came out for the original Xbox. It wasn't for the Dreamcast.
It did. Yeah. It was when I was at Xbox. It came out, but a Sega developed game. And I'm trying to think whether it came out in the Dreamcast at any point. But you do Sonic, you do Crazy Taxi. You might do, because you could, I don't know, Sega Rally, I used to love.
Oh, that's a good one. You know what was cool, too? Choo Choo Rocket was really good, I think.
Choo Choo Rocket would be easy. There's not much to that, right?
Yeah.
If you remember Choo Choo Rocket and then Puyo Puyo and a few other little, more bite-sized games. And Choo Choo Rocket had no IP in there that I can remember that you would have an issue with. Yeah, you could do Choo Choo Rocket pretty easily.
Yeah. Peter, I think that, and it's true what you were saying, like, I think there's a lot of games at that time that they had a lot of licensed music, man. So if, Sega ever decided to release any of them, it's going to be kind of difficult, man. Like, it was even difficult just to bring back the original Jet Set Radio from the original Dreamcast. They had it. I know they ported for 360, PlayStation, all the current consoles too, but it was really hard to get a lot of those songs, like, permission, to be available in that game. It was so hard, man.
Well, to that point, I say Crazy Taxi, and then I suddenly think of all the licenses in that game. You remember the soundtrack was Bad Religion. There was another band, begins with an O. Jeez.
For Crazy Taxi?
Crazy Taxi, yeah.
Yeah. There was a lot of there. I can't remember. But I know the Jet Set Radio had Jurassic 5. Only here in the States, it was Jurassic 5. I think Rob Zombie, I can't remember. There was one more too. It's kind of hard.
Well, I'm trying to think. Space Channel 5, you could probably do as well, because I think there's original music. I know there was a Michael Jackson cameo in there, Bigali, and of course you'd probably want to scrape that out.
Yeah.
given where we're at today.
Yeah.
There's first party Sega would know, Sega of Japan would know what they can do easily, what they might have to spend a little bit of money on. It'd be great to see, a little mini Dreamcast or something and with some VMUs and pump it out on some GD ROMs and go from there.
Oh my God, Peter, I apologize. I totally remember now. So right now, this is a very small community that they figure out how to hack the system of the Sega Dreamcast and have like their own servers, and they still play to this day in 2019, man. Do you believe that?
That's insane. I do believe it. I mean, unfortunately, the encryption was cracked pretty early on, and the GD-ROM, which they felt would be very difficult to crack, it was cracked. But I don't think we suffered too badly from counterfeiting. It doesn't surprise me. There are people still come up to me today. I want to talk about the Dreamcast, and as I've just done for the last 30 minutes with you, I've got to go back in my memory banks and go figure out which file folder all those memories are in remind myself.
Yeah. No, I just want to say, Peter, man, I appreciate you taking your time. I know we've been talking about this for months, and I'm glad that we finally make it. Dreamcast, the Atari 2600 changed my life because my grandma bought me that console when I was a little kid. But Sega Dreamcast was like a very special console for me, man. And I know it's a lot of people that feel that way too, man. And you were part of history too, man. You know, so
yeah,
20 years.
It's great. People stop me and chat about it, and I have to remember a bunch of stuff. But yeah, it's been a phenomenal ride. And God, 20 years. Who knew? Well. Yeah. Look forward to my post on 99. I'll do something. I'll find something.
Yes. You should find something very, never been seen before or something, man. Like, oh, look, I got something here.
I'm sure there's something out there. All right.
Danny. Awesome. But thanks a lot. Thanks a lot, Peter. Take care, man.
Bye. Bye.
Send us your feedback or questions. Give us a call at 786-273-7GTR. Email us at fanmail@gamertagradio.com. Or leave a message on speakpipe.com/gamertagradio.
All right, so that was my conversation with Peter Moore. Yes, Daily Conversations. Please let me know your thoughts. That was awesome. Awesome. So head over to gamertagradio.com, post your comments and feedback. Make sure to spread the word, subscribe, follow us on any podcast platform. Just search for Gamer Tag Radio. And let me know on Twitter. Follow me, Godfrey, GODFREE. Let me know your thoughts about my conversation with Peter Moore about the 20th anniversary of Sega Dreamcast. This is a podcast exclusive. Thank you for listening. And until next time, we're out. Peace.
Thanks for listening to Gamertag Radio. Be sure to like us on Facebook and follow us on Twitter.